Welcome, welcome, guys. We are back for another episode of The Lock-In. Yes, another episode. I lied to you during the last episode from the Irish Open. I called that one the last one. It turns out it wasn't. I'm Unibet Ambassador David Lappin, and I'm joined, as usual, by Unibet Ambassador Dara O'Kearney. That's probably the last time I'll say that out loud, Dara, because, as you know, as I know, the sun is setting on our time at Unibet Poker. Just 2 weeks left.
Yeah, I can't believe we're still doing this show. You promised me the last one was the last one, and it turns out it wasn't the last one. And now I have to even doubt that this might not be the last one, because you might tell me tomorrow that you want to do another one with, you know, who knows who.
We'll sneak one in on the very last day.
Yeah. But we have a major guest finally on this show, because this show has kind of fallen a little bit behind the chip race in terms of the quality of guests. We have managed somehow to secure poker's leading influencer.
That's it. Joining us this week is a man whose rise to international stardom, no less, over the past 2 to 3 years has been meteoric. Purely coincidentally, that's roughly the time he became newsman for the chip race. He is a celebrated and award-winning author whose best-selling books include The Mental Game of Poker 1 and 2, Poker Satellite Strategy, PKO Poker Strategy, Endgame Poker Strategy, Mystery Bounty Poker Strategy, GTO Poker Simplified, and the GPI Global Poker Award-winning Beyond GTO Poker Exploit Simplified. He is the GPI Global Poker Award-winning Twitter Personality of the Year. He is the Meme Lord. He is Barry Carter. Barry, welcome.
Wow. It's so obvious that you had to read all that out, because there's no way Dara was going to reel off all the book titles correctly and in order.
Look, the fantastic people at the Hen and Mob /GPI had an event here in Malta a week ago, and they did that thing that a lot of people do, assuming that I'm actually the same person as you, Dara. And I just have a little surprise for both of you. They gave me your trophy.
Okay. Oh, piss off.
Your trophy. Mine now. I wrote the book.
Mine. That is so cruel. I have such a trophy-less existence. And you've got one of the ones that I actually can claim to be my own.
It's a really lovely trophy. Yeah, Eric,
you're gonna bring it the next time you come to the UK or Ireland for us.
It's very heavy. I might actually charge you for an extra bag.
I think that's my trophy, though, because the font is quite big on it. So I imagine that's my trophy.
You're right.
Harry has like a smaller trophy with like tiny font on it.
I'm the only individual trophy winner here. You can have it, Dara.
Well, I don't want you to do a, you know, Mrs. Doyle, no, you have it off here. So we'll move on. But so basically what happened was I played a casino tournament in Puerto Maso last night, and a girl came up to me and said, we have your trophy behind the cage. And I went, oh, cool. And then it turns out they didn't. They had your trophy. So well done, guys. That was my big surprise. That's the big reveal. Actually, that's the only reason we're having this episode. So we can go now.
Fair enough. Yeah, fair enough. They're probably going to give Barry our podcast one too, which would be kind of funny.
That would be funny, yeah. Let's do that.
Look, apart from the books, you guys have really branched out actually in the last good few months, creating your own training site as well. Fans of the show probably watched the Simplify Poker Behind the Solve series of strategy videos we put on the YouTube channel. How's it been going for you guys? You're, what, maybe 6 months out from the soft launch, maybe 3 months since the hard launch?
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, it feels like it just kind of, I woke up one day and suddenly there it was. It came in gradual degrees. You know, myself and Barry were making videos, which we were just selling on another site. And then we decided, well, let's have them just on our own site and sell them from there. And then we kind of gradually grew. And then we launched the Academy, which is the $50 a month subscription where people watch exclusive videos as we make them, webinars as well. We had Turlock on last month reviewing my deepish run in the recent Sunday Anniversary Million. And sort of central to it, we have this community forum where basically a message board where people can post questions and hands and also brags, because like a lot of our students are actually doing very well. So that's coming on very nicely, taking far more time than Barry told me it would, but you know, I'll forgive him for that.
Yeah, it's there really is a third guy in this particular ensemble now, and that's Dave Kingston, who's the I think webmaster is the correct term for the training site part of things. But it really was his idea. I was somewhat reluctant to do it straight away. I did like the idea, but he convinced us to go all guns blazing with it, and it's proved very, very successful so far. Everybody seems to be really enjoying it. We create content at this academy, but the secret sauce is actually the community that drives it. They're actually driving the future of the content, and it's been a lot of fun so far. But yes, quite time consuming.
Yeah, I think if you're allowed to be called Meme Lord, he's allowed to be called Webmaster. That seems only fair. Barry, I want to come to you first on a proper topic now. You were recently brought on as an ambassador by Party Poker. You're too polite to say, but you've actually been in demand by loads of brands recently. Party have acquired your services. They attempt to revitalize their live offering, I know. Sarah and I spoke to Raj, actually, over there at Party Poker recently, and she was telling us about the numbers for that London event recently exceeding their expectation. Party are something of a sleeping giant in the poker space. It's a brand, I think, that has still very strong name recognition in the UK and elsewhere. Do you think that they can make a splash with what I believe is several live stops across England and Scotland?
Yes. There is a huge gap in the market in the UK right now. There's one operator dominating the entire market. Fair play to them. Grosvenor have done incredibly well, especially since PokerStars essentially exited the UK market. But there's a massive, massive gap. I went to the first Party Poker event in London, and it was lots of fun. It was really well organized. And there's a real emphasis in my mind on the satellite qualifiers. There were things for people to do away from the tables. There was a party on for the players. There was a spin the wheel thing where you actually won some quite sizable prizes at no cost. And the satellites themselves are very recreational player friendly. They're very flexible. There's package. You can win packages for side events. And all of the things that I think potentially put off people who don't play a great deal of live poker, like myself, from playing, I think Party Poker have got the bases covered. And as you mentioned, they're a very, very trusted brand. Your money is safe at Party Poker.
Yeah, it's great to see. To pick up on one thing you said there, and Dara, to bring you in, one thing that's noticeable is how since, I guess it was when the UK IPT was disbanded the first time around a decade or so ago, all the liquidity for live poker in the UK was sort of gobbled up by Grosvenor. Now, I'm not super on the ball when it comes to the UK scene, but from what friends have said to me and a couple of guests on this show have alluded to over the last year or two, Grosvenor in that monopoly position have worsened structures a bit. They've allowed late reg, preposterously late, I think 5 big blinds in some cases, basically done some of the things that, you know, is a bit greedy, but brands do it when they don't really have competition. Is there is it nice to see Party jumping back into the ring, so to speak? And is it generally good to see other online brands, I suppose, partner with live operators on the ground in the UK to run some events?
Yeah, I mean, competition is always good. It's funny in a sense, people are talking about like the rise of Grosvenor when Stars effectively exited the live scene in the UK. But really, like when I started back in 2008, Grosvenor had a very similar position to what they have now. The GUKPT was the big tour, and then Search of Stars came along, and you know they had the UKIPT, and it was on TV, and they sort of blew the GUKPT away for years. But the GUKPT survived, and then thrived again after the UKIPT died. And you know, there will always be complaints about tours, etc., etc. But down the years, the GUKPT had done a pretty good job, and you know they have a good casino network as well, where they run their events. But it is definitely good to have competition. Anytime, it's always bad for poker. Like I remember the first time I said this was maybe back around 2012 or so, when Stars were effectively online. They had a monopoly, and I said it to people who worked for Stars. I was like, "Yeah, Stars are great, and like you treat the customers really well, and that's why you're in the position you're in. But it's a terrible thing in the long term for anybody to have a monarchy, a monopoly, because ultimately they end up abusing it.
Also a monarchy, Darren. I agree with that as well.
Effectively a monarchy. Like all these mon words are, you know, mono means one, and it's very bad when one entity has such a dominant position. And you know that was proven ultimately to be the case when Amaya came in. I had seen it time and time again in tech sectors which I had worked in before. There always emerges one winner, and that is always a terrible thing then for the customers, because when one person has all the market, they can't get any more of the market. They have all the market. The only way they can make money is by jacking up prices or reducing customer service. And they generally try to do both things, which is exactly what happened under Maya Year Stars. Rate went up, you know, more rate is better, according to Negreanu, and customer support deteriorated. It's definitely good. And it's good to see online brands again recognizing the value of live. Because there were a few years where online sites have kind of taken the view, oh, well, you know, it doesn't really translate that well onto people playing every night on our site. But here in Ireland, you know, we have seen, for example, the Irish Open has really benefited from its partnership with Paddy Power and Stars and the American sites and all the other people that they've that qualify for them. And the Irish Poker Tour has really sort of reignited Paddy on a grassroots level, where lots of players who sort of didn't play online anymore, now they suddenly reactivate their old account to start playing IPT sats, and while they're there, they want to play some other stuff as well.
Yeah, well said. Interesting you bring up our old beef with Negreanu there. We may as well bring up all the old beefs. It is the last episode after all of the lock-in. We may as well just, you know, go out with a proper bang here. All the things we've been wanting to say for years. On a serious note, from live poker, I guess, closer to home to maybe live poker further afield, the WSOP is obviously on the horizon now. WSOP travel concerns is this topic. Now, it's more than fair to say that a decent number of people are having travel concerns while others are likely to stay away for other related reasons. I wrote a piece on this a couple of weeks ago that went sort of poker viral, mainly, I think, because anything political probably gets helped by the algorithm and people engaging with it a lot. Much of it not positive, I must add. In the piece, I referred to Trump in a way that I thought would be uncontroversial and not really bother either side. I called him the disruptor in chief, but that line seemed to really get under some people's skins. I frankly said that under him, established deals and long-standing agreements are not worth the paper they're written on, and in short, trust is gone. Now, for me, that's just sort of a fact. He has torn up lots of deals, reneged on America's commitments on several fronts, but it bothered people to read that. Dara, we chat politics a fair amount, and you recently said to me how you don't think that the chaos is the point, that it's the strategy, but rather a product of his haphazard or maybe impulsive nature. Before we get to how this affects the WSOP specifically, can you elaborate on that general point?
Yeah, I mean, I actually read his book, The Art of the Deal, back in the 80s when it came out. And it's quite an unusual business book, to say the least. But in recent years, the actual author of that book has come out and said that essentially the situation he was dealt with was he had to deal with an individual, Donald Trump, who there seemed to be no real master plan or anything. It was just chaos. Everything was chaos. And the best he could do was sort of present that chaos as a strategy in the book and say that, you know, well, this is kind of the point. You're putting people off balance and so on and so on. And it was quite a compelling argument. A lot of people still kind of buy that view. But it's difficult to see that there is any real strategy there. When you look at, for example, his actual record in businesses, bankrupting casinos, etc., you know, if that is a strategy, it doesn't seem to be very effective. And you would think that by now, if he was strategically motivated, he would be saying, okay, maybe this is not the best strategy. When it comes to the one area where he has actually genuinely succeeded is reality TV. And reality TV does benefit from that sort of like create chaos, be the center of attention. And I think I could be wrong, but it feels very much still like that. He's used to sort of bending the news narratives, you know, imposing tariffs one day, getting rid of them the next day, and both those days, that's the thing that's most talked about, rather than any overarching strategy of fundamentally changing the American economy, because even the stated goals keep changing as well. Like the tariffs are supposed to bring in lots of money, and then they're not. Then that isn't the goal. The goal is actually that it's supposed to bring manufacturing back to the U.S., and then that's not the goal either. So, yeah, it's difficult to see. In terms of the travel, like I am one of the few who is actually traveling to the WSOP this year. I have a very strong feeling it might be my last ever WSOP. Not just because of the travel concerns and so on. I have actually spoken to American friends, and I do have a feeling maybe that stuff is a little bit overstated. There have obviously been individual cases of people being detained, etc., etc. But for the most part, the risk seems fairly low. But you know, there's a number of things about the WSOP which are becoming making it less and less attractive to me.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Okay, so for the last few weeks, in case people have been living under a rock, many international poker players have been, you know, booking their annual pilgrimages to the desert. And I guess the uncertain climate that we're in right now have meant that many, including myself, I will say, have reconsidered taking this trip, a trip that I've really enjoyed over the last 6 or 7 years. A month or so ago, Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt took her usual spot at the podium and delivered some disconcerting news and... just basically, well, I'll read from her statement. Dara loves when I do this. All foreign nationals present in the United States longer for than 30 days must register with the federal government. Failure to comply with this is a crime punishable by fines, imprisonment, or both. If not, you will be arrested, fined, deported, never to return to our country again. Now, a lot of people who enter America on vacation do so with an electronic system for authorization, the ESTA, or a B2 tourist visa. That's the majority of poker players, I think, crossing the border. With both the ESTA and B2 visa, the person is registered. But there is ambiguity there whether a stay of over 30 days would require a second registration. Also, all visitors to the US are obliged to carry evidence of that registration on their person at all times. Failure to supply this evidence, if approached by law enforcement, is a misdemeanor, the penalty for which is a fine of $5,000 or imprisonment for up to 30 days or both. Barry, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think it's far-fetched that a person from the UK or EU, say, would fall foul of US immigration?
Very possibly. I think the bigger risk is just overseas travellers are going to view America as a very unwelcoming place this year at the World Series. And there's already reports from the Las Vegas Tourist Board that visitors have dropped by 8% in the last month, and casino revenues have dropped 5% in the last year on year. And I think the ambiguity, the confusion is just going to put a lot of people off, especially people from Canada, I would say, who make up a big part of the World Series overseas visitors base. So yeah, my prediction is that we're going to see numbers down across the board.
Yeah, that was a great point. Canadians are 6% of the World Series entries, and you know that's chunky enough. If a third of them don't show up, and it is about a third down in terms of people going south of the border from Canada at the moment, ever since the 51st state nonsense was being spouted. I put forward my personal concern that, as I suppose I'll call myself an outspoken critic of not just Trump, but much of the American political system and American foreign policy, my social media could land me in trouble. That would genuinely be of concern, to be honest, in this climate. I was watching my favourite comedian the other night, Stuart Lee, on Krishna Gurumurthy's Ways to Change the World podcast, and he made the point that he wouldn't go to the US right now to do a comedy gig because he'd be afraid that he would be held for even just like a couple of days without access to his heart meds. And just, you know, any kind of concerns people have, the minute they just sort of run through the scenario where even if you're detained overnight or for a day or just... As soon as that gets into your head, I suppose what I'm trying to get here is that the rhetoric right now is really off-putting. It's sort of what you said as well, Barry. If you're Canadian, if you're pro-Palestinian, if you're someone who tweets their anti-MAGA views. But look, let's stick to the World Series, but maybe switch across to some new rules that they've implemented. This is going to start sounding like a Bill Maher piece now for real time. New rules. Let's rush through them, actually. Rule number one change, what's being called the no-show policy. Rule 16 states that if you register and don't arrive to your seat until the first official break, your stack will be removed from play and you will not be eligible to compete in that event. Your buy-in will be refunded. Nothing really to discuss there, just a bit of a PSA for people who watch this show and are traveling. Second rule change, getting banned. Rule 18 allows the WSOP to ban players before, during and after a tournament for reasons such as cheating or abusive behaviour. Ali Imsirovic, and I guess the mouthier players out there, beware. Again, probably not much to discuss there. But number three is one we should talk about. Call it permitted devices. The WSOP has written a new policy which states once participants have reached the final three tables in any tournament, all approved electronic devices must be removed. An announcement will be made to participants once they've reached that stage to remove all such electronic devices. Failure to do so will result in penalties up to and including disqualification. Dara, how do you feel about this one? We're both phone users at the poker table, but I think phone use during this sort of late stage, three tables, two tables out, it probably does, even in our cases as maybe phone addicts, cut back to a bit of a minimum because you're extra focused on what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like lots of places already do this. It's just kind of the WSOP is implementing a rule which they've never had before, but other places do. I'm certainly used to being deep in tournaments and being told, okay, we're last three tables now, you can't use your phone. And that's fine. Like, if that's the rule, that's the rule. Completely understand why it is the rule as well. I think it goes kind of hand in hand with another thing which they've said, which is that in-game coaching isn't allowed anymore. Now, that personally makes me sad because I did very much enjoy and benefit from people reaching out to me when they made a final table or whatever and being able to coach them. And it was sort of a mix of both formally, like people doing that, more typically professionals rather than recreationals. But then, you know, sometimes when a recreational that I was friendly with was deep in a tournament, they'd send me a message like, okay, I have 20 big blinds. What should my rough overall strategy look like with 80 people left? And I would give them advice in running. That's apparently against the rules now. So that's one of the things I mentioned earlier, why the WSOP is becoming less attractive to me. That's one of the things I actually used to enjoy quite a lot about the WSOP. But you know, if it's against the rules, it's against the rules, and I completely understand why it is against the rules. And they're perfectly within their rights to enforce that rule. The no electronics rule is probably a good one, to be honest, because people are playing for a lot of money at that stage, and it definitely opens the possibility of cheating.
Well, let's jump to that one, the one that you segued to there. That's rule 116 about players no longer permitted to discuss strategy with an outside source at any time while in the tournament clock is running and participants are not on a break. So the only time a player could legally get a bit of coaching, say from you or another coach, Dara, would just be at that 15-minute break when they leave the tournament area. And I don't want to get into tournament area semantics here either. Barry, you made a very funny joke about this one this week. Would you mind repeating it?
Well, I make a lot of funny jokes, David, so you may have to narrow it down. But I think you're referring to... I tweeted out that if anybody wants to hire me to shout strategy advice to players at the table who are quite tough, to then potentially get them a penalty, I'm more than up for it. But you know, I can't see people actually doing that. Last year's shenanigans at the main event final table forced the hand of the World Series to implement some rules like this, and I think they've pretty much covered all the bases with the phone usage and the coaching. I'm not sure how something like what happened last year, or more nefarious versions of what happened last year. You know, obviously, we acknowledge that what Dominic was doing on the rail was not cheating, but it just didn't look good. So, no, I'm in complete agreement with all of this. It's a necessity.
Fair enough. But I'm going to just be devil's advocate for a moment and push it back to Dara. Who's to say that when you're whispering to your mate on a rail, which is still allowed, by the way, so long as that mate's not on a device feeding you information, who's to say that he's telling you about your bubble factor and the range and the shape of your range in certain spots against a certain player, rather than just talking about how it's, I don't know, $8 for a fucking banana in the shop? Like, you know, are they going to be like having enough staff to stand beside everybody who's whispering to their mate on the rail? Like, I just don't know how it's policeable.
Yeah, good luck with that. I mean, the WSOP is very understaffed at the best of times. I think one of the problems with the rule is I feel like it's kind of unenforceable. And when you have unenforced rules, then the people who benefit from that are the people who are best placed to sort of work around the rules. Whereas if you have a transparent, like, well, everybody can get coaching, then that kind of creates a level playing field in its own right. But it's a tricky one for sure. It really doesn't feel enforceable. And then, you know, like, what's going to happen? Like, if one of my students is on a final table and he comes over and he's saying something quietly to me and the tournament director sees us, but he doesn't hear what we say, is he going to accuse us of cheating? We have seen, you have definitely seen cases of floor staff overreach at previous WSOPs. So you can probably imagine the kind of situations that could arise. And, you know, just one final point, and it's a very minor point, but it's weirdly defined as when the tournament clock is running. Like, does that mean when the clock is stopped, for example, on bubbles between hands, it's okay for me to walk over and tell somebody what their bubble factor is?
Great point.
I don't know why they linked it to the clock running. They could have just said, except it breaks.
Yeah. So
yeah, and I feel like, I suppose one more thing about this as well for me is that, and you alluded to it there, Darren, like the WSOB staff are overzealous a lot of the time. Like I've seen them, you said overreach. Like I've seen them enforce the stupidest rules that like are just wrong, just plain wrong, and shouldn't exist. And now they're going to have another rule that they can hearken to basically, you know, shout the odds and boss people around. And I have been in a situation with WSOP staff where that's quite unpleasant, to be honest. And now they're going to feel not only armed with this new rule, but almost like an obligation to use it because, you know, they have to make examples of people. Barry, what do you think of that?
Very possibly, but I to defend the WSOP, I feel like the fact that there is a written rule, even though it's ambiguous and it can be enforced incorrectly and aggressively, I think will circumvent 95% of the problems. There will definitely be edge cases, but I think the more likely response from most players is that they will be super strict with themselves, making sure that they're not receiving coaching because there's a rule and they don't want to get into trouble, especially as they're down to the final few tables where there's more scrutiny and stuff. So there's definitely going to be edge cases. I've written a column for Poker Strategy with my predictions for this year. And one of my predictions is there's going to be some sort of controversy involving a phone/strategy advice. I think it's definitely going to happen, but I think it will be an edge case. And I think for the most part, this will be a benefit rather than a hindrance.
Well, look, to the other two rules that have been altered. One is very small. It's about where the button goes at the start of play and when there's 3, 2, and 1 tables left, where, you know, the technicalities around a dead button, I think, are in there. And then the other one, which is kind of interesting, rule 86, used to be about how dodging the blinds incurs a penalty, but that was that has now been rewritten to be a bit more specific and exact. It now states a participant who intentionally dodges his or her big blind when moving from an existing seat must forfeit both blinds and big blind ante if applicable and will receive a 1-round penalty, thus obviously losing another set of blinds and whatever opportunities they would have had in that orbit. Dodging the blinds when switching to a new table will essentially cost a player 2 rounds now as opposed to just 1. Darren, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, this is always a contentious issue because ever since the big blind ante was introduced, it has become very advantageous for somebody if they can potentially dodge the big blind to do it, because they're dodging not just the big blind, but also the ante, obviously. And there have been some very egregious cases of it, and it does piss people off. I remember last year I actually arrived at a table and I saw I was about to be big blind and I sat down immediately and the whole table complimented and commented favorably on the fact that I had done that. It's something that particularly annoys recreational players, and I think people probably take it too far as well. Like I definitely felt like the goodwill EV I got from people seeing that I was willing to take my big blind straight away helped me in that tournament. I was very short in the bubble and I got a few walks, for example, and I do completely understand the rule. The problem with the big blind ante is, you know, we've all been in a situation where you have 8 big blinds, you post 2 of them, you lose those 2 big blinds, then they immediately break your table, you get moved to another table, you get moved in on the big blind, because often it's the guy under the gun who's bust last hand because he's found a spot and he's taken it before the blinds have hit him. Now you're big blind again, and you've lost half your stack. But, you know, that's unfortunately the way that it is. Maybe there should be a little bit of leeway when somebody is coming from the big blind, for example, and they're short stacked. But, you know, that would probably be very difficult to actually implement in practice too. So, yeah, I mean, I understand the rule. I, for one, would never advocate trying to dodge the big blind.
No, and I think you just have to ease it and accept that, like, in the bigger scheme of things, we'll all have occasions where we didn't quite get the big blind and then got moved in behind the button and got a good little run of luck there by getting extra hands before we posted. And then there'll be times where we get those 2 in a row and that kind of sucks. But, you know, in the bigger scheme of things, it'll average out. Look, speaking of controversial rules, I want to turn now to the EPT Monte Carlo main event, where New rail rules were adopted on the fly a couple of days ago, stating that electronic devices and any coaching from the rail was no longer permitted. That's obviously not an EPT specific rule, but, you know, in a way that's, you know, them reacting to, I guess, what's sort of in the zeitgeist right now. And it's topical with the WSOP. The reason for this was Boris Angelov, who actually coincidentally would have had a front row seat because he was at the WSOP main event final tail himself last year. He had been popping over to the rail quite a bit during the feature table on day five, where his pals were giving him the info from the 30-minute broadcast. You know, obviously 30 minutes ago, you get to see what the cards were and you want to get that info as quick as you possibly can so that maybe you can use it to your advantage against these guys now. Eventual winner Alexander Shevliakov protested this by not showing his hold cards on the final table, which in turn really annoyed Amir Kokistani, who said that if Shevliakov wasn't going to show his cards, then he wasn't going to show his. And this just kind of created a slightly farcical situation for a couple of hands where tourney officials told Shevliakov that he had to do it. He didn't do it once again. And eventually they made this ruling stating that, you know, people couldn't be on the rail giving that information about you know, people's hold cards even half an hour later. Barry, what did you make of this one? It's basically the players forcing what is the new WSOP rule by taking issue with the stream info being conveyed. And I guess doing the one thing you could do in protest, which is sabotage the coverage.
Yeah, it's in hindsight, it's amazing that this hasn't been a rule for a decade at this point now. From a pure kind of the flow of the game flow of the stream, I'm amazed that operators still allow people to feed information about a hand that had been played 30 minutes ago. It just doesn't have a natural kind of narrative, I guess, if someone's just going to shout, yeah, he had ace king or something like that. So I'm actually amazed this wasn't a rule already. Yeah, I mean, I guess I completely agree with it as well. It does seem a little bit unfair that one player was getting information where the other ones weren't, and the big player protesting about it. It's just kind of like a live stream version of the show one, show all rule. If, you know, if one's not doing it, then we all don't want to do it. But it's funny because I'm sure you're about to mention, the player in question who was protesting was pretty controversial for other reasons at this particular final.
Yeah, he sure was. And I'm going to get to that and actually get you to tell us that story in a moment. But first one, to just push it back to you, Dara, on this. One solution in my mind on this subject is, why not just have a screen somewhere just like to the side that is visible from the final table where they're playing the stream coverage, and you could just see the half hour delayed stuff as it's playing out.
Like, yeah, that's a very obvious.
Everyone have the info now.
Yeah, that's a very obvious solution. And I played a feature table in the Bonington, I think it was IPO, where this was exactly the case. They had a screen behind us, which was showing the thing, and people were looking up and seeing hands that happened 30 minutes ago. So therefore, everybody has the same access to the same information. Yeah. And I think that's an obvious idea. Triton obviously do it very well too. They put all the information on their app, so people can just check the app, and they all have the same information. Streams themselves are kind of problematic in a sense when you think about it, because like usually organizers add streams for a variety of reasons, primarily to advertise their event. But you know, the players are not compensated in any way for being on streams. That kind of, you know, there is always this disconnect, I think, between poker and other sporting endeavors, using the term very loosely, where, you know, for example, in golf, all the money that flows in from television, et cetera, a lot of it gets redistributed into the players. The players don't pay their own entry fees. It's all added to the price, but that just never happens in poker. Yet we're supposed to basically bow down and do everything we can to facilitate the organizers in terms of the streams, showing our hold cards, et cetera, et cetera. I'm actually surprised that more players don't object to showing hold cards. But it has sort of become the norm now. And it's really going to come into sharp focus at times when people have, let's say, unequal access to that information. And, you know, yeah, you're right. The TV screen over the, or a few TV screens around the feature table are the obvious way to get around that.
Yeah. And I think in the sort of post-possible world, there's paranoia out there as well, whether it's well-founded because you are suspicious about the people running the stream, or if it's you know, not very well sounded because, yeah, I think I would have a lot of trust in your Tritons and your Poker Stars, and, you know, big operators are probably running a squeaky clean system there. But you never know. You know, you never know who's hacking into what. I suppose that's the paranoia that creeps into people's minds, and the way they can be sure that no one will get any info or knowledge about their cards is to put them in the box. And that's what Shevliakov did. Anyway, Barry, as you pointed out rightly there, Shevliakov involved in another controversy involving himself and Wakil. Would you please tell me about that one?
Yeah, what happened was Wakil opened from under the gun, six-handed, with queen-jack suited. It folded around to Shevliakov, who was in a small blind. And he, so Wakil min-raised. Shevliakov raised to like 2.9, 3.2, something like that, something that was an under-raise. He claimed that he was unaware that Camille had raised under the gun, and said he was actually just raising the big blind from the small blind. He was forced to double the bet size because it was an under-raise. It came folded back around to Wakil. I think he asked Shevliakov, did you mean to do that? And he said no. And eventually, Wakil decided that because Shevliakov was on potentially an incredibly wide range, it now made shoving with Jack Queen suited. I think he has 16 big blinds, very profitable. Unfortunately for him, Shevliakov actually had Ace King suited, I believe, called and won. I mean, the
if looks could kill, Barry. If looks could kill.
The real controversy came afterwards, because it seemed like an honest mistake, and Wakil certainly thought it was an honest mistake. But the other players at the table told him as he was leaving the table that he'd done the exact same thing about two tables previously, when we were kind of at the around the final table bubble mark. So I believe now Wakil believes it was a deliberate angle shoot and not an honest mistake.
Yeah, and to quote from Wakil, who took to Twitter last night, he said, aside from the very clear photo below, included a picture there where he can be seen staring directly at me as I'm waiting to act, here are the three primary reasons, in no particular order, that I believe this was a deliberate angle. One, I used up my entire shot clock 15 seconds before opening, and I verbally announced my raise and size. The dealer then also verbally announced my raise and size prior to the action coming to him. Number two, this was the first time at this final table of six where he verbally announced any raise or bet size in any hand that he was involved in, interesting in itself. And number three, as soon as he was all in and as soon as the all-in was taking place, Boris Angelov called him out for fake misclicking and then let us know that he'd done the exact same thing with, you know, two tables out or whatever it was in the same event. Dara, end of the day in these spots, like, angles are actually within the rules of the game. They're certainly not within the spirit of it. I thought it was a kind of a dangerous thing to do with 30 bigs there, was to jam over the top. If he wanted to sort of suss out if his opponent was at it or not, he could have gone for a non-all-in four bet and then folded, knowing that maybe something was awry. Or he could have just flatted with the queen-jack suited, which is obviously a hand that is quite playable. I'm always, when I'm faced with these situations, and I think we're all faced with them, you know, probably not even that infrequently. People misclick all the time. And, you know, once in a while you do think, was it a fake one, was it not? And sometimes you get a bit suspicious that it might be. I always sort of assume that it might be. Maybe it's my nature. And sort of don't do what the guy trying to trap me would do, and generally do look to take maybe the passive line where I can navigate it or do something different. Now, that probably allows me to get angled in another way, in where I'm not sort of allowed to take my optimal line because of my paranoia. But the danger of taking your optimal line and the guy was trapping is obviously, you know, potentially disastrous too.
Yeah, it's a difficult one because, you know, you'll be right sometimes, and that will reinforce your view that it's best. But then there are other times where you're losing equity and you're not really that clear. Like, Queen Jack is an interesting hand because it is the type of hand that you would just love to play in position. It pretty much defines itself on the flop. Like, if the flop comes, you know, ace, XX, and you got absolutely nothing, you can kind of just get away from it. Or if it comes all low cards and you got nothing, similarly, you can assume you're behind a lot of stuff. Obviously, the difficulty here is that he assumed his opponent had his small blind raising range, which is, you know, very, very wide and very, very polar. But even against that kind of range, like, there is a very strong argument to be made for saying that Queen Jack suited is actually best played as a flat because in trouble against the top of the range and it's in great shape against the bottom of the range, and you're retaining position by just flatting. So I think flatting does seem like the most sensible thing to do in cases like that. I have misclicked quite a lot down the years, and I've also been the victim of people doing it as well. It's not helped by my color blindness, so I have actually gotten to the habit now of declaring my bet sizes as I'm making them. Sometimes it just speeds things up, because if you're raising to 2.9 and you're counting out 900 chips and everybody's waiting for you, that can annoy people. So I will just start counting the chips and announce the amount and then put out that amount. But you know, at a recent tournament, I think it was the Monster in the Green Isle, I declared I think it was 1900, but I put out a 25k chip by mistake. And I just said raise. But then I said the 1900. So if I hadn't said the 1900, my raise would have been a massive over raise. So I think my only real point here is that it's good to declare the amounts, because that makes it very clear to people what's happening at the table.
Nara, what do you think of if Shevelyakov was angling him, what do you think of him doing this particular line with ace king? Because to me that seems like a bad hand to do it with, because you
great,
it's in not great shape up against any hand, really. It just dominates the ace x hand.
Yeah, if he knows exactly what his opponent has, queen jack suited, then he would actually prefer to just shove and have the queen jack suited fold, and that's a higher equity play than reopening the action. And you know, depending on the ICM situation, it might even be better than inducing a hand like queen jack suited to shove itself and then have to call off, depending on what the risk premiums were. So yeah, nobody other than the player himself knows what his actual intention was. The fact, you know, people are saying, oh, it's the first time he announced a raise, but you know, it's an awkward amount, 2.9, and that's why I mentioned the fact that I did it recently as well. When you are raising these awkward amounts, I think you are more likely to verbalize the amount.
That all makes sense, and I do agree. I agree with all those points there. I think, you know, playing ace king as a trap like that is very dangerous, particularly in a high ICM environment. Anyway, side note from Monte Carlo, congrats to Maria Konnikova, who won the closing event. Delighted to see her pick up another one of those little spadey trophies. So finally, before we go, a reminder that our last show, our last Chip Race episode, is scheduled for about a week from now. And I can now confirm that it will be a Unibet reunion of sorts. Joining us will be the World Series of Poker main event champion Espen Jørstad, double 888 Live champion Ian Simpson, Norwegian poker champion Monica Vaca, and Triton commentator Henry Kilbane. On that note, it remains for me, for the final time, perhaps, to thank our guest Barry Carter.
Thank you very much.
And Dara, thank you so much.
Thank you, David. Pleasure as always.
Think of seasons that must end. See the rivers rise and fall. They will rise and fall again. Everything must die again, like an ocean to a shore, like a river to a stream, like a river to a stream. It's the famous final scene. how you tried to make it work. Did you really think it could? How you tried to make it last? Did you really think it would? Like a guest who stayed too long, now it's finally time to leave. Yes, it's finally time to leave. Take it calmly and serene. It's the famous final scene. It's been coming on so long. You were just the last to know. It's been a long time since you've smiled. Seems like oh so long ago. Now from the screen, from the famous final scene.